Hello, 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 and welcome back to Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Gallup, and today we'll be diving back into the story of Ionia State Hospital. And I wanted to give a quick shout out to all the new listeners from Michigan who found my podcast this week. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome. It's been really fun to hear from people who've told me that a family member worked at Ionia back in the day. I think these stories are really important to share. There's so much we can learn from the past. Today, I'm going to be sharing the story of one patient, Alice Wilson, as it's detailed in the book, The Protest Psychosis by Jonathan M. Metzl. Now, it's important to note that Metzl changes the names of the actual patients in his book to protect their identity. The disadvantage of this, of course, is that I can't look up additional information, so I'm relying solely on the book to tell their story. Again, I highly encourage you to find this book, The Protest Psychosis. Metzl goes into the nitty-gritty of changes in the hospital, which I'll touch upon in an upcoming episode. And if you need the spelling, the last name is M-E-T-Z-L. So for now, come on in and get comfortable as we go behind the walls of Ionia State Hospital. Today's story is about a woman Metzl has given the pseudonym Alice Wilson. Alice was born to Gus and Nora Perkins in March 1910 in the small farming town of Nashville, Michigan. And for reference, Nashville is about 27 miles due south of Ionia and 37 miles southwest of the capital, Lansing. And Alice had a very tragic childhood. When she was 3 years old, her mother contracted smallpox during her second pregnancy and died while giving birth to a stillborn son. Later, Alice's neighbors would tell her that her mother fought against fever, pain, and exhaustion in an attempt to save both her life and the life of her unborn son. They said her screams could be heard all the way out to the road for 3 days until they finally stopped. After her mother's funeral, Alice's father, Gus, removed all of Nora's belongings from the home and laid them in the sunshine, hoping to kill the residual smallpox. Gus could hardly take care of himself, let alone his young daughter, so Alice was sent to live with some cousins who lived nearby. 2 years later, Gus died from pneumonia, and Alice was sent to live with her grandparents in Lansing. So by the time Alice was 5 years old, both of her parents had died from illness, and she had moved several times to live with different family members. This is pretty significant trauma for a child to endure. And I want to go back to what the neighbor said about the death of Alice's mother. Sure, Alice was probably too young to consciously remember her mother screaming in agony for several days before her death, but it's very likely that on a deep physiological level, her body remembers it. There's a fantastic book by psychiatrist Bessel van der Kolk called The Body Keeps the Score that discusses this phenomenon of how trauma affects our minds and bodies. Even before we're old enough to remember this or that, our bodies store information and use it later. For instance, an infant whose parents had a volatile relationship before splitting up when the child was only a couple years old will likely never consciously recall the arguments their parents had. But when the child gets older, all of a sudden the sound of strangers yelling on the street makes them freeze and get nervous in a way they can't explain. I like to think about it sort of like tree rings. I remember in fifth grade, my class took a sample of a tree ring from this giant Doug fir behind our school. There were dark, skinny rings and newer, wider rings. And in the middle, there was this black charred ring. And our teacher explained that there had probably been a fire that had damaged the tree, but it kept growing. The damage had healed, but evidence of the fire was forever imprinted on the tree ring. And that's sort of similar to how trauma works in our lives. The damage may be gone, but its effects can linger long afterward. And I bring this up because Alice clearly experienced several different types of trauma in her young life. Not only the painful death of her mother, the death of her younger brother and father, but also living in different places with different family members. We don't know how or if Allison's cousins or grandparents allowed her to grieve the loss of her parents. Maybe she was told not to cry. Maybe she wept endlessly and wasn't taught how to self-soothe. Regardless, it's entirely possible that Alice didn't learn how to make sense of the tragedy because she was just too young. And I think this plays a role in what we'll see later of her. As she grew up, Alice was described as quiet, timid, and even-tempered, who was always cheerful and friendly. She remained focused on her schoolwork and was said to be a straight-A student who loved playing the piano. She didn't seem interested in romance like many young women her age, and she turned down offers from young men who pursued her. Instead, after she finished high school, she took a job as a teacher, anticipating that she would remain unmarried. However, several years after teaching, when she was 23, Alice met George Wilson, a local newspaper reporter. They got married and had two sons and a daughter. George advanced in his career, moving from being a reporter to being an editor. Alice, meanwhile, no longer had to teach and stayed home with her children. After 8 years of marriage, making Alice about 31-ish, she began showing signs of what was later diagnosed as schizophrenia. Now, I have some opinions about that. Now, here's how Metzl describes the onset of Alice's symptoms. Quote, "As George saw it, the symptoms came on suddenly, though in retrospect she had been off for a while. Normally a meticulous cleaner, she let dishes pile up in the sink and dust build up in the corner. Normally a proud dresser, she remained in her bedclothes until noon. Normally self-assured, she cried, fretted, or chastised herself aloud for not doing a good job rearing my children," end quote. Now, granted, I'm not a parent, but this doesn't seem that unusual for any mother of at least three children. Kids are a lot of work. So it makes sense that occasionally things might slip up and she might doubt herself as a mom. It could be normative parenting anxiety, but it also sort of sounds like depression. We don't know how long before she had her youngest child, so perhaps it could be a postpartum issue. What it doesn't sound like is our modern definition of schizophrenia, or, you know, maybe what we would call the negative symptoms of schizophrenia, like lack of motivation or diminished emotional expression. But even those symptoms overlap a lot with depression. I don't know. I don't buy the schizophrenia diagnosis yet. But the incident that made others question Alice's sanity came during a family vacation in 1941. They had planned a road trip to visit Alice's father-in-law in Biloxi, Mississippi. So Alice, her husband, and three kids left Nashville, Michigan, and drove 711 miles halfway through Arkansas before stopping for a night at a hotel. They stopped at a general store to pick up some supplies, like most families do on road trips, when Alice began to fill her shopping cart with underpants. "The children need clean underpants," she said. "I forgot to pack them." George said no, she hadn't forgotten, but Alice became angry at him and insisted. Finally, she let him return the undergarments to the shelf. They purchased their goods and left the store. As soon as she began to walk to the car, Alice burst into tears. "Why do we need these things? We don't need them. I'm such a bad mother. I provide for no one. I'm worthless." She began pulling items from the cart and threw herself to the ground. Her husband, bless his heart, tried to comfort her, but she continued to cry. A store manager, who was very clearly a sensitive and empathetic man, demanded that she pipe down. Like, "I'm sorry, this woman is clearly in distress, and your idea of customer service is telling her to shut up." Anyway, the manager must have called the police because they arrived and arrested her for disturbing the peace. "I'm worthless," Alice continued to say when the police arrived. "I'm inferior." Again, my reaction to this is not that it sounds psychotic. It sounds like depression. And again, I'm not a parent, but if I had a dollar for every time I heard a parent tell me that they feel inadequate, or that they feel like every other parent is doing great and they're not, I could probably retire today. It sounds to me like Alice is under a lot of pressure. And we don't know what kind of support she had at home, if any. We don't know if her husband generally supported her. There just are a lot of unknowns. So Alice stood in front of the judge for her misdemeanor offense of disturbing the peace and again told him that she felt worthless and inferior. But this time she said something different. She pointed to her husband and children and said she had no idea who those people were and wondered why she should take off with a strange man. Wait, what? What was this? Was this amnesia? Was she faking it? And if she were faking it, why? What could she gain? Regardless of the reason, it was decided that Alice needed help. The vacation to Biloxi would have to wait. So I guess she ended up feeling safe enough to get back in the car because the family returned to Michigan. Alice was first taken to the psychiatric hospital in Kalamazoo and then transferred to Ionia on September 1st, 1941. Her admission face sheet reads as follows. Age 31, nativity, native born of native born parents. Color, white. Occupation, housewife. Religious denomination, Protestant. Clothing, from home. Reason for admission, disturbing the peace, got confused and embarrassed husband. You know, when they say that people were institutionalized for darn near anything back in the day, they were really institutionalized for darn near everything. Got confused and embarrassed husband. So as per usual, Alice was seen by a psychiatrist upon admission. Her admitting physician, Dr. Leroy, began his physical examination of her. Quote, patient is a clean white female who came readily for the examination and was cooperative throughout. Hair is blonde, eyes are blue. There's a mole on the left shoulder. There is no significant asymmetry of the body, end quote. So only the most important observations would do, clearly. Moles, symmetry of the body, whatever usefulness that provides. In all capital letters, Dr. Leroy wrote, quote, patient has bladder and bowel control and exercises this, end quote. For the mental part of the exam, Dr. Leroy wrote that Alice, quote, came readily for examination and was neat in appearance. Patient readily gives her attention to the interviewer and does not appear distractible, end quote. He then lit two cigarettes. He took one for himself and gave one to Alice. He had Alice identify herself, which she did, and explain her profession, which she did. He then asked her the date, month, and year, a standard question that most doctors ask their parents. Patients, not parents. Her response was, quote, I've lost track of the date. I only just arrived here. I believe it is the first week of September. We are in 1936. I'm sure of that, end quote. Now, I barely know what day it is from one day to the next, so I generally don't give my patients too hard a time if they're a little bit off or a little, they have to think about it for a minute. But it was 1941 when Alice was admitted, and she said she was sure it was 1936. Now, that seems very unusual to me, and I wonder if she were exaggerating on purpose or if there were really a genuine confusion about the year. It's hard to say. You may remember in the last episode when I shared the list of prompts and questions that patients would be asked when they were admitted. I asked how you might do if someone asked you those questions on the spot. And here's how Alice did. Say the alphabet. Said well. Count from 1 to 20. Counted well. Name the months. Named well. Repeat the Lord's Prayer. Repeated well. Sing some school song or recitation. Not able to. Now, remember that Alice was a school teacher for at least 5 years. This should have been something that she could have easily done. So it's really curious that she wasn't able or willing to do that here. What's the largest river in America? Now, she said Mississippi like I did, but remember, it's actually the Missouri, but not by much. What is the largest city in the world? Doesn't know. Name some states touching Michigan. Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin. And for our listeners not from the area, this is accurate. What was the War of the Revolution? Evasive, claims not to remember. What was the Civil War? Evasive. Claims not to remember. Who is the ruler of England? Claims not to know. What is 7 times 9? 63. That's correct. What is 84 minus 25? 69. It's actually 59, but... What is 12 times 13? Doesn't know. I didn't remember either, but so I looked it up. It's 156, just FYI. These weren't great answers for a former school teacher, but Dr. Leroy said that she had a low fund of knowledge, though intellect is intact. When Dr. Leroy asked the reason why she was at the hospital, Alice said, quote, "I thought about drowning myself a few months back, but taking one's life is a sin. So I sat at home. I was mentally disturbed at that time, and I wasn't able to take care of my family as I should. I felt I couldn't do my housework, and I was not well adjusted," end quote. Aha. So if I were diagnosing this woman today, I'd be making a mental checklist of symptoms. Depressed mood, check. Anhedonia or loss of pleasure, check. Feelings of guilt or worthlessness, check. Lack of energy, check. Suicidal thoughts, check. Sounds like a recipe for major depressive disorder to me. But here's what Dr. Leroy asked instead. Dr. Leroy, but why are you here now? Alice, we were on the way to Biloxi. My husband said I talked too loudly and got out of my head. I know I let my family down. Leroy notes, patient grins and stifles laughter. Now, this is an interesting note about the laughter. On the one hand, some people laugh when they're uncomfortable or don't know what to say. On the other hand, it could be called what we call inappropriate laughter. When someone is psychotic, sometimes they laugh at things that aren't funny because their emotions don't match with the tone of the conversation. Dr. Leroy, were you out of your mind? Alice, well, I don't think I'm the person to say. I don't know. I mean, don't men become disturbed? Leroy notes, patient ambivalent, evasive. Dr. Leroy, were people against you? Alice, no, that's when we drove home. The trip, it was all hazy to me. The trip coming home. Leroy notes, possibly evasive, circumstantial. I don't feel safe here, if that's what you mean. Dr. Leroy, do you hear voices when there's no one around? Alice, no. Dr. Leroy, did you? Alice, no. Leroy notes, confusion, delusion about the incident. Staff earlier reported patient responding to internal stimuli. Patient denies. So just to sum all that up, Alice has told Dr. Leroy that she doesn't hear voices and never has, but staff said they observed her responding to internal stimuli. Now, we have the same problem today. What does that phrase, responding to internal stimuli, actually look like? In general, although there is some flexibility to it, it means that someone is seen mumbling to themselves or laughing to themselves. It could be a sign of psychosis, but it's not always a sign of psychosis. Some people are auditory processors and mumble to themselves while they work to keep themselves on track or listen to how something sounds. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. Attorneys will get me on the stand with this, and I have to explain the difference between someone who is actively psychotic and talking to unseen others and someone who might just be giving themselves a pep talk or something. It can be really tricky. Following Alice's admission interview with Dr. Leroy, here's what he concluded about his new patient. Quote, Alice Wilson is a white woman of 31 years who appears to have passed through a very confused period. This patient has taken reasonable care of her husband until late. Symptoms include a delusional sadness and irascible feelings of guilt. The patient is evasive and tells very little about her behavior and yet shows a lot. Hospital staff has observed patient responding to internal stimuli, though she has only once admitted to being hallucinated. Overwhelmed by guilt feelings about proper care of her family. Likely date back to her formative years and feelings of failure regarding care of her widowed father. Guarded and mistrustful, end quote. and he assigned a diagnosis of schizophrenia. And using the modern criteria for schizophrenia, I say absolutely not. But I have to keep in mind that the criteria for schizophrenia in 1941 were different than they are today. But it still feels like a stretch to say that this woman was experiencing psychosis. To me, everything points back to depression. But again, and Jonathan Metzl discusses this point immediately after the story of Alice Wilson, we have to be careful not to put modern definitions on something from a previous time period. In 1941, Alice Wilson had a textbook case of schizophrenia. I can look back now and strongly disagree, which I do, but he didn't misdiagnose her. He was doing the best he could with the information and knowledge he had at the time. That's why I consistently come back to Maya Angelou's quote, "Do the best you can until you know better." Now that we know better about our current understanding of the symptoms of schizophrenia, we can make a more accurate diagnosis. But you never know. We might learn something new about the brain that shows us that our current understanding is wrong or incomplete. My patients have heard me say about a zillion times that the brain really is the final frontier. We know more about space than we do about our own minds. And we're just starting to figure out about neural pathways and the reasons why someone experiences psychosis. Even now, we only have theories about why psychosis happens. So Dr. Leroy was using what was known and accepted in 1941 to diagnose Alice, just as I am using what I know and what is accepted in 2023 to make my own clinical speculations. And Metzl pointed this out too, saying, quote, "Depression barely appeared in medical literature before the 1960s and didn't become a viable disease category until 1980, end quote. And see, that's incredible to me. So Dr. Leroy met weekly with Alice for psychotherapy. She talked about withdrawing from her home life and finding no pleasure in her children. Her housework didn't get done, and she really wasn't showing a lot of affection toward her family. Dr. Leroy wondered if her feelings of insecurity stemmed from not being there to take care of her father. To which I say, she was 5 years old when he died. What could she have done? She was a child. That's a different story. Alice was ordered to undergo a series of electroconvulsive therapy treatments, 22 in all, and 15 sessions in the hydrotherapy tub. Metzl said that, quote, "According to the nurse's notes, Alice spent most of her time in her room during the first few weeks of her stay at Ionia. She stared out the window, which looked out over the farm, and talked to herself on occasion. Her appetite was described as sporadic. At night, her crying spells could be heard all the way at the attendant's desk down the hall from her room. After several weeks, however, Alice participated. She knitted and sewed, helped build the Ionia float for the county fair parade, worked in the bakery, and cut fresh flowers into floral arrangements. She taught piano to other patients and played as the accompanist for the women's traveling chorale. Improving, read the nurse's notes, becoming a citizen in ward activities. Very good worker," end quote. 6 months after her admission to Ionia, Alice met with several clinicians to discuss her readiness to go home. She was asked to discuss the incident on the vacation that caused her to be sent to the hospital, along with her understanding of her mental illness. And she added a detail here that hadn't been previously mentioned by Metzl. Just prior to the family road trip, her in-laws were staying with her and her family. Without any other information, I wonder if that had been the tipping point that led her to feeling worthless and inadequate. I certainly don't want to resort to stereotypes, but it seems entirely possible that if she had an overbearing mother-in-law, that might have made Alice feel that she weren't good enough. And maybe she didn't want to go back if they were still there. I'm speculating, of course, but it seems possible. Ultimately, the clinicians decided that Alice's husband could adequately take care of her, so they discharged her from Ionia on March 20th, 1942. Her discharge diagnosis read, paranoid schizophrenia, condition, personality is improved. And so Alice was able to return to her family. She had long periods of time when she would be fine, and then her symptoms would return. She lived with a steady routine. Her husband would leave for work every morning. She cleaned, took care of the children, and played cards with women from the neighborhood on Tuesday nights. The family attended church each Sunday and ate lunch afterward at a local diner. But in the spring of 1964, 22 years after her first discharge from Ionia, Alice started acting strangely. She closed every blind and shutter in the house and even used 5 rolls of toilet paper to fill in the cracks in the blinds where the light snuck in. She kept saying, "The light hurts my eyes." She refused to go outside to do her shopping or her housework, so her husband had to do it all. She complained that she didn't have anything to wear, even though she had many dresses. She threatened neighbors. Something clearly wasn't right. And then in March 1964, Alice's husband came home early one day and found her curled up in the bedroom closet. "They're watching me," she said over and over again. "They're watching me. They're watching me." George didn't want to, but he knew he had to call law enforcement. As soon as they showed up, Alice was once again taken to Ionia. This time she was admitted by Dr. Walter Willis. He observed her to be, quote, "a clean white woman of short stature, 54 years old, who wears upper dentures, ash blonde hair, light blue eyes. She appears polite, overly talkative, cooperative, depressed, guarded," end quote. Dr. Willis asked if she was having any problems with her husband, to which she responded, "I nagged him too much. I guess I just wanted him to do things for me with his own work." Dr. Willis: "Have you heard voices when no one was around?" "No." "Have you been depressed?" "Not nearly as much as I have been before. I'm terribly blue about being here. I didn't want to come, of course." Dr. Willis: "Do you feel you can do housework now?" In the book, there isn't a response to this last question, but it is curious to me that that is the question Dr. Willis asks, presumably to assess her insight. And I keep coming back to the fact that her symptoms sound a lot like depressive episodes. Depression will absolutely stop someone from engaging in their usual work. They can also get sensory overload very easily. So sounds or lights might be bothersome. People with depression will often withdraw and not have the energy to go outside or complete their usual tasks. It doesn't, however, entirely explain the paranoia, although there is a version of major depressive disorder that includes psychotic episodes. In 1964, however, Dr. Willis assigned a diagnosis of schizophrenic reaction undifferentiated type. She was prescribed Thorazine and Stelazine, 2 highly potent antipsychotics, in addition to psychotherapy, group therapy, and arts and crafts. And she was discharged 5 months later in August 1964. And Alice returned home. And over the years, she engaged in her usual activities. She even became a grandmother. And then in early March 1972, 8 years after her last admission to Ionia, Alice and her husband took a road trip to Ohio to visit their daughter and grandchildren. On the way, Alice became increasingly anxious, confused, and vocal. Her husband pulled into a rest stop, but her condition worsened. She pointed at her husband, yelling, "He's out to get me! He's taking me against my will!" Her husband managed to get her back into the car and drove back to Michigan. Over the next several days, however, Alice was increasingly paranoid and believed that women in her church group were conspiring against her. Late one night, she was seen running through the neighborhood, tapping on the windows of unsuspecting neighbors and announcing herself as Mary Queen of Scots. Once again, the police were called. And once again, she was returned to Ionia. She cried the whole way there. "I've lost control of myself again," she moaned. Dr. George Clark and Dr. Sylvan Cabrioto conducted Alice's intake assessment this time. They wrote, quote, "Alice continues to feel guilty about the problems that she has caused her family and the period of time when she was away from her children while she was hospitalized. Pre-admission information indicates that the patient was unable to care for her basic needs and that her husband had to do them for her. During the admission interview, the patient cried and said she was unable to do things at home. She states, "There were so many times when I've broken down, failed." She is neat and clean, occasionally would emote inappropriate affect and emotions. There is an attitude of chronic anxiety and insecurity. Physical and neurological examinations were essentially within normal limits, end quote. This time, though, Alice's diagnosis was different. She had been diagnosed as having schizophrenia for almost 40 years, but this time her admitting psychiatrist looked at her mood and thinking patterns instead of her behavior. "This patient feels helpless and hopeless," they wrote, "and is often confused." They removed schizophrenic reaction from her diagnosis and replaced it with involutional melancholia, or essentially depression. They prescribed 25 milligrams of Valium twice daily and 20 milligrams of Sorrentyl at night. If you're not familiar with these medications, Valium is a sedative and an anti-anxiety. People will often be prescribed it for anxiety or before surgical procedures, like before LASIK eye surgery. Sorrentyl is a neuroleptic drug that is often used for folks with schizophrenia who don't respond well to other medications. It was taken off the market in the U.S. in 2004 due to its pretty nasty side effects that actually ended up causing heart problems. Alice was also given what I would say is a better suited treatment plan. Quote, "Treatment goals are to increase self-confidence, decrease dependency, develop work habits and skills, increase productivity and achievement, increase interactions with others. Treatment approach is active friendliness," end quote. I love that last line about active friendliness. That's the approach I usually try to use with my patients. You know, most of them have been mistreated their entire lives, so I try to really see them and see their strengths. Now, this approach seemed to work for Alice too. She was one of 29 women at Ionia in 1972, and she met others who were in similar situations of coming from a lifelong schizophrenia diagnosis to depression. She went through individual and group therapy, participated in bingo parties, and attended various community outings like shopping trips into town and visits to the Ionia Free Fair. Her chart described her as a happy, calm woman whose emotional distress resolved within the therapeutic milieu. She only stayed at Ionia for 2 months this time, and she wouldn't need to be hospitalized again. Now, I want to emphasize here a few details about Alice's case. First is that her diagnosis changed with the revisions of the DSM. Although her symptoms first met the criteria for schizophrenia, that later changed to depression. Second, she was never seen or described as violent, even though there were a few times when she got a bit sassy with her doctors. And third, her last admission in 1972 showed a huge change in the way she received treatment. It was written in her treatment plan to approach her with active friendliness, which clearly seemed to be effective for her. Unfortunately, the patient we'll discuss next week will not have the same good fortune. The changes in the DSM seem to benefit Alice and provide more clarity on how to treat other patients like her. For the patient we'll discuss next week, the changes in the DSM served as a detriment to his treatment and became an all too familiar story, not only in Ionia, but around the US. So stay tuned for that story next week. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to all of you who have joined the Facebook group this week. I changed the settings of that group, so hopefully more people can join in the fun. If you haven't been to the Facebook group or the Instagram page for the show, please check them out. I post pictures there from the story so you can attach faces to names and get a sense of where these events took place. So if you need that information, on the Facebook group page is called Behind the Walls Podcast. And then on Instagram, it's at Behind the Walls Pod. So as always, do the best you can until you know better. And then when you know better, do better. Until next time. Thank you so much for listening to Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. Once again, I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Gallup. Cover image is by Christopher Payne. Check out my website at behindthewallspodcast.buzzsprout.com. Follow the podcast and learn more on Facebook at Behind the Walls Podcast and Instagram at Behind the Walls Pod. For questions or recommendations, email me at behindthewallspodcast@gmail.com. You can find new episodes every Monday on Amazon Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening right now. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find and listen to the show, and I would be so grateful. Please stay tuned for more episodes of Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. Until next time.